Chapter 6, Non-Bengalis in Bangladesh. Following the experience at Shahid's uncle's house, it was important to find out if this was typical of the treatment of non-Bengalis who opted for citizenship of Bangladesh. So I posed the question to those in the camps. Could you have left the camps voluntarily and opted for citizenship in Bangladesh? But there were others who never were in the camps. Seeking them out and getting their views was more of a challenge. Those of the camps were in two categories: those who registered with the ICRC as Pakistanis, and those who claimed citizenship of Bangladesh. By far, the vast majority registered with the ICRC claiming Pakistani citizenship. At that time, they were under the impression that only by declaring themselves as Pakistanis would they qualify for repatriation when the time came. And they had every reason to believe that once a treaty was signed and relations were normalized between Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh, they would be included in the exchange of populations and release of all prisoners of war. Another strong incentive to register as Pakistani was to eat. It was the only way they could qualify to receive rations. A third incentive were the forced evictions of those who had chosen to attempt to remain in their homes, evictions that went on from December 1971 through 1978, the confiscation of all their businesses, and the locking them out of all jobs. And finally, of course, many still clung to the concept of Pakistan as their spiritual homeland. But once they registered with the ICRC as claiming Pakistan nationality, they suddenly found themselves locked in by laws passed in Dhaka, barred from the right to own, claim, or sell confiscated property, or to attain citizenship of Bangladesh. The laws not only barred those registered, but also applied to their children. Those laws have never been rescinded. Even those who later discovered Pakistan would not repatriate them could not change their claim from Pakistani to Bangladesh nationality. The same applied to their children. In other words, Roan Tempest of the Los Angeles Times did not check out the reality and context of statements made by the reporter's sources in Bangladesh. There was a small minority who, though forced into the camps, left their options open by not registering as Pakistanis. Some registered, but did not register a spouse. I found ample examples of those who did this, but not in Bangladesh. I found them in Pakistan and in other countries. Most of those who could or did claim Bangladesh citizenship used it to sell property for whatever it took to leave the country. As for the claim in National Geographic that 200,000 non-Bengalis had left the camps, it became apparent after conducting countless interviews that the vast majority left the camps to vacate the country. While in Bangladesh, I also saw little evidence to substantiate claims that Biharis were assimilated into the Bengali community. But before dealing with that issue, I would first like to direct the reader to an official document produced in this chapter, and to an account by Shams Rezad Ahmet, who provided that document. Prior to December 1971, Shams Rezad Ahmet was an employee at the American Consulate in Dhaka. My home in Mohammedpur was not abandoned, he said. I chose, after the creation of Bangladesh, to remain in my home. I never went into the camp and did not register with the ICRC as opting for Pakistan. He told of staying locked in his house for 8 months, gradually selling his belongings for food. I spoke fluent Bangla, but my height singled me out at once as non-Bengali. Ahmed is large-framed and 6'3". He described his attempts to leave his home, even 6 months after the war. People would see me on the street, spit on me. Roving gangs went after me. Even my neighbors, who had been friendly before, would call me Bihari rubbish. On August 30, 1972, he found a notice nailed to his door. It was an official document ordering him to vacate his property, and it was issued by the Bangladesh government. I was out of possessions to sell and down to my last 400 takas. I knew the army would be coming by morning to enforce the eviction notice. I might be arrested, beaten, or even killed. he saw his only choice was to leave his house voluntarily and before morning. But where would he go? To a camp? He'd seen enough of the camps to know of their squalor. So finally, he decided on an alternative plan. He decided to go to the American Embassy. Since it had been a consulate when he worked there, he wasn't even sure if anyone he knew was still there. But I felt I had no choice but to take the risk and find out. He managed to get a taxi, but the driver demanded 1,000 takas to take him to the embassy. I told him I only had 400, and then held my breath, and prayed as I never had before that he would accept it. He did. Then Ahmed related the terror of the ride. The driver had my life in his hands. He could have forced me out somewhere on the road, dropped me off anywhere, taken the money, and what could I have done? There were no laws to protect Biharis. Someone could stand up and kill us in front of a police station, and they'd just watch, and maybe join in. Ahmed was taken to the promised destination, and with the help of his American employer, who was still there, working at the embassy, given a visa to the U.S. and an airline ticket. Ahmed currently lives in New York. One of the Biharis who hold citizenship are not in camps and have remained in Bangladesh. It was difficult to find many, but I did manage to find a few. Some were married into Bengali families. Many in that category have been passing as Bengalis. Those who cannot pass, whether they are intermarried or not, walk a precarious line. As it turned out, Shahid's uncle was a very typical example. The following is another, who agreed to be interviewed, but asked me to leave out any details of his life which might reveal his identity, which included his occupation. He was stiff and uncomfortable when Shahid handed him a letter from his son, who was living in Pakistan. He read, tensely absorbing the contents of his son's letter, then looked up and said, "I'm sorry, but even talking to you could be dangerous for me." It was obvious he held a high position. "I suppose you must think I've sold out." "My job while here," I responded, "is to simply record what you say." He slowly ran a finger down the edge of the envelope. "I had to send my son out of the country, because there are no opportunities for him here." After a long pause, he added, "I have a skill and specialty that for now is needed." "Are you able to keep in contact with anyone in the camps, and perhaps offer help?" His face became ashen. "In my position, I'd end up with them if I went anywhere near the camps, or displayed any sympathy or identification with them. I think I've said more than I should already." He rose to signal an end to our conversation. Nervously, he thanked Shahid for bringing the letter, and then took 1,000 takas from his wallet and handed them to him before turning to me and saying, "Perhaps this contribution will help in your mission. I don't want you to get the impression that I'm not agonized by the suffering in the camps. What you're doing could be a tremendous help to them. I'm a citizen of Bangladesh, but they're still my people." He then said, "I pulled up my roots from Bihar in 1947 to come here, but I just don't have the strength to face the uncertainties of another migration to Pakistan when I know that country has turned its back on us." Prior to 1971, non-Bengalis were highly represented in the skilled and semi-skilled trades, as well as in the professions. But what I found in the Bangladesh of 1986 were few who had skills needed at the moment, and living a life that almost seemed like house arrest. But by far the majority living outside the camps, if they had jobs at all, were in hotels and restaurants as cooks, dishwashers, busboys, and bellhops. They lived in a country that has literally banned their language. Except in camps, Urdu is not even taught as a second language. Urdu books, magazines, and newspapers are banned and cannot be bought anywhere, nor found in the libraries. While instituting Bangla as the official language is not negative in itself, official suppression of a minority language does pose the question of the right of a minority group to retain its language or culture. There was no evidence of Bangladesh offering the full rights of citizenship to non-Bengalis, unless forcing them to pass themselves off as Bengalis in order to work, receive education, or even move about freely in the streets, is considered a legitimate form of assimilation. English, unlike Urdu, did not suffer the same fate during the national fervor to raise Bangla as the medium in commerce and in the schools. English, in fact, continues to be highly favored by the educated upper-class Bengalis. Ironically, the attitude toward West Pakistanis visiting Bangladesh is quite different than the attitude toward the so-called Biharis in their midst. West Pakistanis are, in fact, not only coming to Bangladesh in large numbers to invest and even reclaim businesses they owned prior to 1971, but are being encouraged to do so. Many are taking advantage of the need to reopen mills and factories that have remained closed since the creation of Bangladesh, and are playing the same role they were supposedly hated for in the past. An even greater irony that was never anticipated by the Biharis when they registered with the ICRC as Pakistan nationals was the reciprocal freedom of those with Bangladesh citizenship and passports to travel to Pakistan. Had that registration with the ICRC not locked them in, the only obstacles to overcome to get to Pakistan would have been the fees for a Bangladesh passport, a visa stamped at the Pakistan embassy, and the cost of an airline ticket. It also seems that as the two governments of Pakistan and Bangladesh move closer to more friendly relations and mutual trade, the oppression against the non-Bengalis, both in and out of the camps, appears to worsen.